Hi, everybody. I highly recommend the When Dating Hurts podcast. I found the podcast after I left an abusive relationship, but it continuously helps me on my healing journey. The podcast always reminds me that these people are damaged, they're emotionally draining, and they're dangerous to be around. I appreciate everything Bill has done for people like me. It keeps me from ever even considering going back. Love should not hurt. You deserve respect more than anything in a relationship. Take your power back and live the life you want to live. You deserve it.
When Dating Hurts podcast continues to grow in popularity. The more who listen, the more who will know the realities of dating and domestic violence. In the meantime, the When Dating Hurts book in paperback, ebook, and audiobook is being purchased and read by concerned parents, teachers, victims and survivors, and of course, those who are currently dating. Education leads to empowerment. That way, if a potential abuser is targeting you or someone you care about, you will know how to detect it and how to break free and stay safe. Up next, another survivor story to illustrate how an innocent person can become manipulated and trapped in abusive relationships. Deborah's story continues with her return to the States with her soon-to-be husband, Scott. Like so many of these stories of abuse, the relationship takes a turn for the worse with the child on the way. We get to know what's really going on in Scott's mind, and he's not the great guy he appeared to be. His father might even be worse. Deborah's ability to keep her mind together is put to the test over and over again. The evils of narcissism are on full display in part two, the final episode in Deborah's plunge into and ascendance out of domestic violence.
When we were redeploying to come back, I found out I was pregnant the week we got back. When we first got back, we shared a two-bedroom apartment with one of my closest friends at the time. When I told him the news, he immediately proposed.
Oh, how about that?
Which was interesting. But one other very relevant detail is that he was already paying child support to somebody else for a then 3-year-old son.
Okay.
Who I met not long after that. He's 17 now. So I found out that I would be having my son. I knew very little about that previous relationship. He had never been married to this other woman. It was a high school romance that fell through. I don't think the relationship lasted long after her pregnancy. So them being a family was never a thing. All I knew about her was what he told me. I don't know how many times we've heard this.
The portrayal of her was not that positive. Maybe she was really difficult, crazy, sometimes enters into it. Let's see where this one goes.
She had cheated, from what I understood. He ended the relationship when he found out that she was cheating. Again, of course, this was all his side. All she was interested in was getting the biggest child support check that she could, and that she always had boyfriends who were not very nice to his son. But he was also not going to a lawyer to try to get custody of this kid either. I encouraged him to and finally got him to, but he never seemed like he was really that interested in it. He wanted to say that that's what he was doing. You know, oh, I have a lawyer, but it looked good on paper. That was it.
He wanted to let that part of his past go.
Right.
Yep.
But we did get that young man fairly frequently for visits. We were still stationed in Texas at that time, and he lived in Louisiana with his mom. So we would meet halfway in Houston, and we would do that drive a lot. I had my son in 2010. Things were starting to really go downhill by then. That mask was really starting to slip by that point. I'm pretty sure that he was at least having emotional infidelity. I'm pretty sure he was looking for other forms of supply at that point. You can tell when they're irritated when you question them. Questions that people that shouldn't bother people. They don't want to be bothered with it. So you know that there's something going on. You just can't put your finger on it. And I was always the kind of person that gave people the benefit of the doubt. So it took me a little bit longer to see what was going on. I became very easy enemies with his other child's mother. He encouraged it. He drove the narrative that she just wanted money and she never wanted him to have his son. I later found out that not 5 or 6 weeks after I had my son, they did have an affair.
Who is they in that case? You mean he and his?
His other child's mother.
Really?
When my son was about 6 weeks old, I flew up to Pennsylvania so that my parents could see their grandchild. The whole time that I was gone, he wanted to be in Louisiana instead of Texas. And I thought, you know, he was hanging out with his dad during that time. Well, it turns out he wasn't spending as much time with his dad as I thought. But I did not find out about that until later when this custody battle really got going. She knew that telling me about that was going to divide him and I. And so that's how it came out. She said, well, I was with him while you were, you know, in Pennsylvania with your parents. So how do you feel about him now? Her and I have talked about that since. We've had a bunch of conversations over the last couple years about what was driving the narrative at that time and why we felt the way we did about each other. They were good conversations. Not everybody gets to have those. So the way he triangulated that situation was perfect. We each believed what he wanted us to believe. There was something else going on too. There was another one. There was another woman. I knew I couldn't prove it. I couldn't catch him. But my body knew. You just know. And I guess it's intuition. I don't really know.
When you were talking about him being so abusive or so bad with you, but you haven't really told us what he did so much. I mean, I'm sure he was off-putting and said things that weren't very nice and all, but you haven't really told us.
While I was still pregnant, there were a couple times that he lost his temper. He would punch walls. One night, we had gone out to like a club. I was pregnant, of course, so I was the DD. At some point during the night, he had disappeared and we couldn't find him. We gave up looking and we only lived a mile or two from there. So we decided to go back to the house. And there were 3 or 4 of us all living in the same house, you know, renting different rooms, you know, subletting. And so we all decided to just go home. And an hour or so later, he kicks in the front door looking for me because I left him. When he finds me upstairs, he doesn't go after me. He looks at me and then he looks at the window and then just goes and tries to run through the window, like in an apparent suicide attempt.
Oh, goodness. Oh.
There were quite a few witnesses.
What actually happened? I mean, he goes and runs into this window. I mean, I guess
this was thankfully a strong window.
So it didn't shatter and all that?
So it had, you know, the metal frame inside of the window that gives it a look like there's a bunch of small windows and a big window.
Yes.
So it was this type of window. It cracked in all the places that were glass, but you're not going through that thing.
Ah, it's dramatic.
From everything that I recollect about that, I don't remember police showing up. Or they may have, you know, this was in the middle of the night. I was very tired. And there's a lot that, you know, I'm writing this down so many years later. And there's bits that I'm sure I disassociated from because the whole thing was just, who wants to remember that? The trying to jump out the window thing, you don't forget. At least that part.
No, it's not an everyday thing. That's for sure.
I was 4 months pregnant at that time.
Were there other instances where he physically laid hands on you or suffocated you or anything like this?
This next portion is very relevant.
Yes.
And I mean, I know all of it is. After I gave birth to our son, he had another affair, but this was with a close friend of his wife. And that friend was deployed at that time. So he saw an opportunity to just kind of do what he wanted on the side. I'm sure that he told her that I was going crazy or that I had gone crazy. I was suffering from some postpartum depression at that time. I had gained a lot of weight. That was a very hard first few months after I had my child. I knew this was going on, but part of his promise to his friend was that he was going to help her because she was basically a single mom while her husband was deployed. So he would go grocery shopping with her and all of these things to help her unload the car and all of this stuff. She was also pregnant. It was easy for them to make it look like he was just helping her. I knew it was more, but I couldn't prove it. And one night I was sitting there in my living room and I had a glass of wine in my hand and I was so angry that I knew the truth, but I didn't know. I felt so out of control and I was so mad. I squeezed that wine glass until it broke in my hand. It cut me so badly that I walked over to the sink and I was watching the blood fall from my fingers and I felt nothing. I was completely numb. Scott walked into the kitchen and he was like, "Are you okay?" And I was like, "I don't even care. I don't care if I'm okay." He said, I'm going to call an ambulance. I think that you need to get patched up and you need to talk to somebody. He said the right thing, but his reasons were different than somebody wanting you to get help when you're in a situation like that is the right reason to get them help. He saw this as an opportunity to continue to paint me as crazy. So documenting that as well as he possibly could was his goal at that time. So I went to the hospital at Fort Hood. They patched me up. They asked me if I wanted to hurt myself. And I told them I don't want to die, but I don't want to live. And so that constituted suicidal ideation. And I voluntarily went into inpatient mental health care for a week. I gave my life to Christ in that mental health ward. I'd lay there for days. I didn't want to talk to anybody. I didn't want to eat. I didn't want to do anything. And this huge man, he was probably like 7 foot tall, male nurse, comes and knocks on my door and says, "We're going to have Bible study in a few minutes if you're interested." And I was like, "Oh, not really. But if you can show me how to apply that to my life and it can make it any better than it is right now, I'll listen." And my life completely changed that day. And of course, you know, it doesn't happen overnight. It doesn't happen overnight, but that was the beginning.
Yes, that's wonderful. So happy to hear that.
And I truly believe that I'm still alive today because of that. The resiliency that my faith gave me over the next 8 years because I started that journey probably saved my life. It's wonderful. So I came out of the hospital thinking, okay, I don't care what's happened in my marriage before this. I'm going to fix my marriage. I care about my marriage. And I started reading books on repairing marriage after affairs. And after the affair, what do you do? How do you gain trust again? Scott was on a completely different trajectory that he had already started when I went to the hospital, which was, "I'm leaving you for my friend's wife. Everybody thinks you're crazy now. I want a divorce." I was heartbroken. I had some wonderful friends at the time who convinced me to come live with them, my son and I. Just wonderful people. He became a pastor later. He was in the army with me and has been like a second father since then. He became my spiritual father. I checked myself out of inpatient mental health care, and he did not want to fix the marriage after that. So I moved in with those friends, I want to say 6 months later, and I was doing very well. I thought I was doing very well. I guess it didn't work out with this other woman, and he convinced me that he was wrong and that we needed to fix our marriage, and if I was still interested, that there was a path to that. And I bought it hook, line, and sinker.
How about that?
The institution of marriage is very important to me, which is funny coming from somebody that's been married, you know, three times, four times. I had a very short marriage that I annulled between my first and second husband that I don't consider. Because of my new faith, I became somebody that had this deep desire to forgive. Scott really took advantage of that and used it to hoover me back in to fixing this marriage. We went to marriage counseling for a short period of time where he learned how to better fool me. Marital counseling can be a tool for abusers to learn how to become more efficient abusers.
Oh my God. It's like training.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
So when the scammer uses the hypnotic method of building rapport, then they create dysfunctional, delusional reality.
That's how a scam begins. Convincing the mark that it makes perfect sense to hand over their money to a con artist. The Scams and Cons podcast tells you how scams are run. You'll hear how people are convinced to buy fake art, buy machines that print money, or steal your house.
I get a phone call from my wife, and she let me know that they had decided to move all our stuff out. I can no longer do anything about it except go through an eviction.
And you'll hear it from the experts, people who run the cons.
So we go to your bank, you go in and get $6,000 cash, give us each $3,000, we give you this. Uh-huh. You go home, and what you find out is cut up newspaper.
It's fun to know how the trick is done, and that's what Scams and Cons is all about. Listen at scamsandcons.com or wherever fine podcasts are found.
He ended up having some serious back problems that caused him to have to leave the military. He got a medical retirement because of these back problems being so extensive. Medical retirement is basically the same as a regular retirement financially.
He's not going to be doing much, and he's getting checks anyway.
Yeah. So his plan was to go back to Louisiana, and I only had another year of active duty on my current enlistment, and I was going to go into the reserves after that so that we could live in Louisiana. But things got exponentially worse when we got to Louisiana. Then I had no support system when we went there, because I was still in a place where I was trying to figure out how I was going to handle everything, how I felt about myself taking this person back, and how to rectify all of that in my mind. Infidelity will leave a woman feeling very unsure about herself and how she views relationships. I started going to drills with the Army Reserve. One of those drills, I ended up having my own affair. I immediately felt remorse and shame and everything that should go along with making a decision like that. I immediately told my husband. His response was to punch me in the face.
Oh, no. Yeah, it's interesting when the whole thing turns around the other way, what the result is. Interesting. He didn't like that very much.
That was the catalyst for the physical abuse to start. I drove up to my parents after that incident, but came back a week or two later. We had just finished building the house that we were going to live in, and I thought that we were going to move past it. I completely blamed myself for the punch in the face, I was still in the mind frame that that's something that he almost had the right to do, or he was, you know, lost in emotion when that happened. And that's a forgivable thing in my mind at that time. Well, you know, he's never done it before. This is probably something maybe you punch somebody over. You know, that was where my mind was at the time. A few months later, we were sitting on the couch in our house that we had just moved into. Out of nowhere, his hands are on my throat. And he was choking me. It lasted quite a while. I remember everything starting to go dark. For some reason that I still don't know why, he let go. I journaled it the next day, but I didn't say exactly what happened. I had just wrote in my journal, my throat still hurts a little bit. I still, even at that time, didn't want to write down exactly what had happened for fear that he might actually pick my journal up and read it and see what I was writing.
Sure, of course.
When I was writing all of this on my website, I was afraid that he might still see it now, even though we talk on a daily basis about our children. And it's my story. It's mine to tell. I'm like, I don't know if I want to put this out there. I don't know what the ramifications would be, but I'm to the point where I don't care anymore. If you didn't like what I was going to say about you, don't do it. You know,
I think sometimes we reach a point with things in life where we worry them out. Like, I can't worry about it anymore. I'm done worrying.
Yeah.
So just what happens, happens. I'm okay with it.
Exactly. These were the big things, but you know, the smaller things were, if I knew that an argument was coming, I would hide my keys, I would hide my purse, I would hide my phone, I would lock my car so that he couldn't go and disable something in my car to keep me from leaving. There was this constant me walking on eggshells and power struggles. I could never really work on myself. The one thing that I did for myself that was one of the best things that I could have done was, in order to cope at that time, I would go for these long runs and I would sign up for these half marathons. And every morning I would lace my shoes up and I would go out the door and I would run 5-6 miles, depending on what I was training for, sometimes even more. That left me mentally in such a better place to deal with things like that. I think if I hadn't have been in such a physically healthy place, I believe it would have had, you know, a more adverse effect on my mental health as well. That physiological health is something that we're, you know, still learning a lot about, but they're definitely interconnected.
And I think too, by going out and running, when you kind of exhaust yourself a bit, you also feel good that you got a lot of the tension out. You know, you just kind of come in, take a shower, renew. Mm-hmm. So it probably was very good for you too, in saving you, actually.
Yes. Yeah, so there were things that I was doing that were serving me very well throughout all of this. In 2015, for some reason, he was trying to get this full disability that he couldn't quite get. And I never put the pieces together until later, but he decided to... Or he had this episode where he decided to just fire this handgun that we had around the house, not at anything, not at me, even though I was there, but just into cabinets, into floors, things like that. And I quietly walked out, called 911, walked up the road. And so when the sheriff's department shows up, I told them he's got PTSD. I don't think he wants to hurt anybody. I think he's just having an episode. This team comes in and gets him to come out, and he ended up spending a couple weeks up in a VA mental health facility for a couple weeks.
Wow, that's an amazing scene.
It was. He had barricaded himself in our shed when they came, and they're there with a bullhorn like, how can we get you to come out? How can we get you to feel comfortable enough to trust us? And he was like, can you send in my dog?
Negotiator dog.
So our golden retriever went in and comforted him for a little while, and he decided to come out. When somebody has PTSD and they're also dealing with these narcissistic tendencies, it's hard to know what's causing what. We had a polypharmacy in our home of all kinds of different things that they give these veterans when they're dealing with PTSD and also like physical pain from different things, after surgeries, trazodone, gabapentin, duloxetine, prazosin. It's extensive. It looked like I could have just had a window there and started making prescriptions for other people. So you don't always know what's causing what, but that can make you excuse something that has nothing to do with PTSD as PTSD. So I was very reluctant to walk away from this because who walks away from a wounded warrior? Who gives up on a veteran with PTSD? And so there was a lot of guilt that went with that. Also in 2018, his mother committed suicide.
Oh no.
She was living in another state and she took her life. She didn't have anybody. When we found out about it, we booked a flight the next morning and went straight there, took care of all of the arrangements. I'm glad that I stuck around that long because I don't care who you are. Nobody should have to go through something like that by themselves. I'm very glad that I was there for him during that time.
Yes, that is good.
Something else that I did notice, though, when his father found out what had happened to his mother, his father thought it was hilarious.
Oh, no.
Which I had never seen somebody react that way. I was never as aware of this person's malignancy.
Yes.
As I was after that. He believed that.
She had left many, many years before, but in his mind, it somehow was paybacks or something. I don't know, right?
I believe that. I believe that's accurate.
So it's like, good for you.
Right.
It almost as if it proved him right in some fashion, I guess, in his convoluted mind.
That makes sense. That makes sense.
You got what you deserved and you did it to yourself.
In 2019, I had to go away to a military school up in Wisconsin, and I was going to be training for a month. So I spent a month around people that were my peers. Most of them were my age. And it was a good situation. It was a good place to be. And I was surrounded by people that respected me and I respected them. And then during that last week, as it was about time for me to get on the plane to come back, I was like, I don't want to go home.
I don't want to leave this.
I don't want to leave this.
Yes.
This is great. Why can't I be around something like this all the time?
Why isn't this my life?
Something just, a switch just flipped in my head, and I knew that I just couldn't live that way anymore. I had really paid attention to what the other side looked like, to what healthy looked like. And I thought about my children, and then I thought about how I wanted them to know what healthy looked like too, because they didn't currently. I had our daughter just before his mom's death, and so she was about 3 at the time, and I was having to make a decision. What do I do? So I started slowly planning my escape. It was methodical because I wanted to make sure that there wasn't going to be any altercation. I did this in secret. I got a storage unit. I started slowly putting things in it that I knew wouldn't be missed. I said that I was going to be going on orders. I was not going on orders to go anywhere. I needed an excuse to be absent, to plan me going somewhere. I had a camper trailer at the time, so I told him I was going to use that while I was on orders because it wasn't that far. And I set up in a campground a couple towns down, started putting things in storage. So in June of 2019, I showed up at our house with 5 squad cars from the sheriff's office and an emergency custody order to take my children.
Wow, you really did it right.
We didn't even go down the road. And I try to coach people on this when they're considering doing this. You have to be very careful how you do this. These are the most dangerous days.
Yes, it is.
Those first couple of days are the most dangerous days. And so I didn't go where my camper was at. I took my children to Texas to stay with those same people that took me in years earlier after I had gotten out of the hospital. And I was trying to decide, where do I go? Do I go to Pennsylvania or do I stay in Louisiana? What am I going to do? I decided to just leave it up to God and stay in that camper for a little while. I didn't want to make any quick decisions. I wasn't sure whether I wanted to share custody or not. And that's hard. That's hard because you don't want to take the children from the parent that they still think is fine. And I think if I'd have taken my children to Pennsylvania, they never would have known how their father really was. And they're getting a very early education on what this looks like and how to properly deal with it, how to set boundaries. Mm-hmm. I'm able to have these conversations with my children that they're learning things as children that I never learned as a child because I didn't have these questions. I'd never seen these things. My daughter, especially, she's 8 years old and there's going to be no pulling the wool over her eyes by the time she's grown. She has somebody's number within the first few minutes of talking to them because she's already had to deal with a lot of things from very young.
It's a tough education, but it was done in a very practical way.
Yeah.
And therefore it's in there. It will never come out of her mind.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because I decided to stay in Louisiana, a couple other things did happen before he finally decided to give up and look for a different supply. When I purchased a home, he showed up drunk one night and I wouldn't let him in. So I have like a little guest house and he walked over there and broke the window. But when he did that, he cut himself so badly, he cut himself all the way to the bone on his forearm.
My God.
And I had to call an ambulance to have them come get him because he was bleeding everywhere. I'm ashamed to say that I thought about waiting a little bit longer to call. I'm glad I did because I don't think I could have lived with myself if he hadn't have made it.
Temptations like that would present themselves under those circumstances, so it's understandable. Sure.
Right. Right. I had to put cameras all around my home. He showed up another night when I wouldn't answer the phone and I wasn't home, and he punched one of those Ring doorbells until it broke because he couldn't get a hold of me. But I just kept replacing them and kept documenting. He finally gave up, found somebody else, and I became like everybody else to him after that. When he shifted his focus, I was no longer the target. So I am now treated the way he treats everybody else. And everybody else likes him. You know what I mean? I don't know how to explain that.
But the war with you is over, at least.
Yeah. Through my website and through my blogs, I'm trying to continue to find the meaning in all of that. It's weird to feel grateful about the experiences that you've had because they were so negative, and nobody should ever have to go through this stuff. But there's no way that I would be on track to be a therapist right now if I hadn't have gone through these things. I never would have wanted to help others in this way. I wouldn't even be thinking along these lines if I hadn't have gone through these things. And so in a way, I'm so grateful for that.
I totally understand what you're talking about. From that standpoint, I have some of that feeling myself. If I could make what happened in our family go away, I would, but I can't. So the question then is, now what do you do? And you have such an empathetic feeling to people because you don't have to imagine what it's like when life throws horrible things at you. You didn't learn it through a book. You learned it through life over a lot of years, a lot of very difficult times.
Best way to learn.
If someone says something, you say, you know, I really, for the most part, I know what you're talking about. And you really do. You know, you're really speaking from your heart. So that's great.
It's sympathy. It's not empathy. Yes. I know what they mean.
Yes.
I know it too well.
You mentioned your website a couple of times. Do you want to tell us what that URL is?
It is socanyou.me. My story's not available right now. I'm still trying to decide whether that's a good thing or not. It may be at some point, but the blog where I write my insights into what I've learned, there's quite a bit on there. And there are topics like, what's the difference between justice and payback? Is happiness possible after being so incredibly broken? And what is that? What can that even look like? What is control? Spotting reverse blame, all kinds of different things. I've tried to pick relevant topics that I have experience in. While I'm in graduate school, I'm not doing it quite as much as I was before. I was doing it weekly. It's looking like quarterly now, but I do put a lot of time into it.
How do they catch up with your blog? Do they go to that same website?
Yeah. So it's socanyou.me, M-E.
Okay. And if they go there, they can find what you've written.
Mm-hmm. The blog is the homepage.
I see. Okay.
There's another part of the site that talks about what relational trauma is versus what it is not.
I really encourage people to take a look at that because I've been there and it is so well written and it's a very generous thing that you're doing. You're really taking what you've been through and turning it into something very useful for other people. So that's so commendable. I really think that's great.
Thank you. It's been useful for me before it was useful for anybody else because it gave me an outlet that I needed while I was still in recovery.
Yes.
Which can take a long time.
Many years ago, I was talking with a guy. I had coffee with a guy who was what you would call a career coach. And we were just talking about careers and different things. We knew a lot of people, had a lot of friends in common. And somewhere along the line, he said to me, I encourage you to do this. Get a legal pad, get a pen you really like, write at least 10 pages on what angers you. Just go. Don't limit it. Don't edit it. No one else is ever going to see it. And maybe after you finish, maybe you're not even going to read it, but just go. And I did. And I wrote probably 12 pages. And I came to some interesting areas of thought I never would have gotten to. And I came to some conclusions about things to take forward that I still do. And this was back in 2013 that I did this. Mm-hmm. So you're right. I think sometimes just kind of journaling, just go, just put your feelings on paper, just get them out. Because one of the wonderful things about writing something is that you could have a lot of different emotions. But when you go to write, you have to put logic to it. You're not just dumping, I feel bad, I feel horrible. My life isn't working. You find yourself starting to write, why is it not working? Why do I feel bad? And I think it kind of becomes your own little therapy session between you, the pen, and the paper. So I think it's really good.
It absolutely does. And if you're not as much of a writer, there were times that I'd be driving in the car and I didn't have a pad and a pen and I had to pay attention to the road. I would record my thoughts to audio instead, and I would just record and I would go off for like 20 minutes. I go back and listen to those still all the time. And I've grown so much since then. And it tells me so much now about where I've come and what my thinking was at that time and what I've learned. So those audio recordings are also really useful.
When you go back to your writing or you go back to listening to the audio of your recordings, it shows you how far down the path you are. So that's good. I mean, you want progress too. You know, you just don't want to keep throwing these things out there and not feel like you're getting anywhere, but you are. But Deborah, you've been victimized by an abusive husband and you are, I'm sure, still feeling like you're recovering from this, but you're, as you've displayed to us over this conversation, you've come so far. And the part I like is that rather than remaining victimized by what happened, you kind of turned the tables on the whole thing and used it in a way to underscore what happened, how it took place, how you got out from under it, and how now you're using it. There are so many people who suffer silently. And when they do that, they don't realize it. But by suffering silently, they kind of continue to victimize themselves. So One of the things that I really caught in your story was when you managed to get around other people, not so much to share your story, but getting around other people, getting away, you know, getting some breathing space, meeting healthy people in healthy relationships, kind of dangled that in front of you enough that you thought, you know, that's what I want. That's what I want my life to be. So I commend you, and I thank you myself and for those who are listening for being so generous and packaging this together and telling us this today. I mean, this was really, I know I got a lot out of it. I'm sure anybody listening to you has gotten a lot out of it, a lot that we can take with us. So thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you so much. And my email is also on that site. So if anybody that's listening has any questions or just wants to bounce anything off of me, please do. Please email me. So Can You is also a Facebook page. So sometimes people interact with me on our Facebook as well. And the links to that and the TikTok are also on the website.
Okay.
I'm very responsive to those things. But thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, thank you. This has been great. This concludes Deborah's story of dating abuse and domestic violence. Had she known the warning signs, she probably would have avoided the heartaches and dangers she experienced. As much as we hope, maybe even pray, to never be confronted by domestic violence, the surest way to remain safe is by learning the warning signs, which you can easily find on my website, whendatinghurts.com. Thank you for listening to the When Dating Hurts podcast. We have been steadily moving up in podcast review rankings based on downloads in the relationships category. That means more and more listeners are getting the kind of advice that can improve lives for victims, survivors, and their families. If you feel we need to hear your story, do not hesitate to email me at BillMitchell@WhenDatingHurts.com. That's BillMitchell@WhenDatingHurts.com. Hi, it's Bill Mitchell. I'm proud to say the When Dating Hurts podcast is part of the Evergreen Podcast Network. To learn more about Evergreen Podcasts or to check out other shows on the Evergreen Network, just visit evergreenpodcasts.com.